Joining us today, and I want to say a special thank you to those people who are watching on various blog sites around the country. There are folks at the World Affairs Council in Pittsburgh, folks on the Washington Note, the New America Foundation, and our online viewing audience is important. And I promise that we're working on getting an opportunity so that some of you can pose questions live as well in the future. I'm Steve Clemens. I run the Foreign Policy and National Security Programs here at the New America Foundation, and it's a real pleasure to have with us today Russ Feingold, of course, senator from Democratic senator from Wisconsin, a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the Senate Foreign Relations Committees. I've had the pleasure of knowing and working somewhat from afar with Senator Feingold when I worked in the Senate years ago for Jeff Bingaman. And I think many people who talk about Russ Feingold talk about him as being one of the real points of conscience in the Senate, not when it's always easy to be so. We were just conversing a little bit about John Bolton. My own activity in the issue of John Bolton's confirmation vote is well known, and I think that my work in that area was very high road, but one of the areas which was not confirmed while Senator Feingold did in fact end up supporting what we were trying to do with John Bolton, it wasn't easy because he's someone who believes strongly that the president should have his or her team, the team that they'd like to have in government, and it has to be a very, very high bar before saying no. And I think that is sort of, I think, very much a part of how Senator Feingold approaches public policy, essentially trying to do the hard lifting and ask the tough questions. And one of the areas in which he's doing this today is in the Senate, in the national intelligence infrastructure, if you will. Recently, we had at this very podium Tom Fingar, who's chairman of the National Intelligence Council, talk himself about the process by which a national intelligence estimate is put together during the various controversies, whether it was the Iran NIE or things related to Iraq or the famous Iraq national intelligence estimate, there became a kind of criticism of the players at hand of an NIE and not much analysis of structure, analytic integrity, how the process worked. And he came in and gave, I think, a very, very reasoned and interesting discussion. And thus, this area of how to look at where we have deficits, where there are problems and gaps, I think is one of the most important areas of policy inquiry and work that we can do. Senator Feingold and Senator Hagel have introduced a bill known as S-3041. I think that Senator Feingold will address that, on Foreign Intelligence and Information Commission, suggesting a new commission to look over the next 2 years at near-term versus long-term threats and security. One of my own often talked about issues in the national security establishment is how reactive we have become to a crisis or pinprick here or there, and how fundamentally we're not necessarily looking at the broad big picture. And while I don't necessarily think that China is necessarily the next big picture, I often tell the story that when I was last in Beijing and dropped in on the foreign relations ministry and talked to a guy in policy planning there, and I said, what are you working on? And he says, he responded by saying, how to keep you Americans distracted by small Middle Eastern nations. And you know, it was both a joke, but there was an element of truth to that that raised fundamental questions about how we prioritize and think about what is serious from what is not, and how to think in strategic terms that are more consistent with the American national interest. So without me further articulating what Senator Feingold is going to talk about, please give a hand of welcome to Senator Russ Feingold, who's going to share some views with us, and we'll be back with questions and comments. Senator Russell Feingold.
Thank you very much, Steve, and thanks to all of you here at the New America Foundation for the opportunity to speak to an organization that has a reputation for innovative thinking and for challenging the status quo when it comes to public policy. In a way, the New America Foundation reminds me a little of my home state of Wisconsin, a purple state that, like NAF, transcends the conventional political spectrum. We sort of take pride in that. As some of you may know, I hold open meetings with my constituents every year, town listening sessions we call them, in every one of Wisconsin's 72 counties. And I've been doing that since I arrived in this position in the U.S. Senate in 1993. From these meetings, now over 1,100 of them, I've gained a pretty good sense of some of the interests and concerns of the very diverse group of Americans that I represent. In the last 6 years of these listening sessions, for the first time, foreign affairs generally and the war in Iraq specifically has been the number one issue, which is amazing because health care overall in the 16 years is clearly the top issue, but it even has beaten out health care as the issue most mentioned in the home counties, not here in Washington, but back home in town meetings in small towns all over Wisconsin. Like so many Americans, the anger and resolve Wisconsinites felt after 9/11 have actually given way to confusion and frustration at the administration's disastrous mistake in Iraq. I hear in my listening sessions how this administration's focus on Iraq has drained our country's energy and financial resources, undermined our military readiness, and stymied action on our country's security and domestic needs. And yet, I also sense people's readiness, even impatience, to take on the real challenges of our post-9/11 world. They're not closing their mind to the need to be involved with the rest of the world. The American people are ready to face these new challenges, but the federal government is not. Nearly 7 years after 9/11, we have still not translated the significance of that horrific event and the responsibility and the opportunity it thrust upon us into a coherent plan of action. Instead, we remain mired in and distracted politically and financially by Iraq. As a consequence, many of the same serious problems that made us vulnerable to an Al-Qaeda attack in strategic planning, institutional readiness, and allocation of resources still remain. My comments today are directed at two fundamental and continuing post-9/11 gaps, a gap in our strategic thinking and a major deficit in our foreign information and intelligence efforts. Until we address these gaps, I believe our country will remain vulnerable here at home. Clearly, the biggest strategic mistake after 9/11 has been the failure to address the threat of Al-Qaeda head-on. Instead, we have conflated Al-Qaeda with Iraq and launched a war in Iraq that perpetuates our military, intelligence, diplomatic, and fiscal deficits and leaves us exposed. In fact, increases our exposure to very real threats to our domestic safety. Most Americans now agree that the decision to go to war in Iraq was the wrong response to the attacks of 9/11. Unfortunately, even some political leaders who acknowledge this profound mistake seem to think that we have no alternative but to just perpetuate it by maintaining a massive, open-ended presence in Iraq. I totally reject this position. We cannot construct an effective national security strategy that leaves tens of thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq indefinitely. The greatest threat to our national security remains Al-Qaeda, a stateless network of terrorists whose leaders have found safe haven in Pakistan along the Afghanistan border and which has a growing number of increasingly dangerous global affiliates. If there is a geographic base to Al-Qaeda, it sure isn't in Iraq. As Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, testified before Congress earlier this year, quote, "The most likely near-term attack on the United States will come from Al-Qaeda via its safe havens in the undergoverned regions of Pakistan," unquote. Likewise, the Director of National Intelligence stated in a 2000 intelligence assessment that Al-Qaeda is now using the Pakistan safe haven to put into place the last elements necessary to launch another attack against the United States. The Atlantic Council, chaired by General James Jones, recently concluded Afghanistan remains a dangerously neglected conflict. That what is happening in Afghanistan and beyond its borders can have an even greater strategic long-term consequences than the struggle in Iraq. Failure would be disastrous for Europe, North America, and the region. Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan are already breeding grounds for insurgency and terrorism potentially worse than before September 11, 2001. And what happens in Iraq, Iran, and in Pakistan will most likely be influenced by conditions in Afghanistan. Now, the war in Iraq not only diverts the vast bulk of our military resources from the more immediate threats to our safety in places like Afghanistan, it also saps our nation's financial strength and our ability to invest in our security. Osama bin Laden gave a speech in 2004 in which he stated very clearly that his goal was to bankrupt America. He bragged about how they did it to the Soviets, and they're going to do the same thing to the United States. When I read this speech to my constituents, they all nod. They see their problems and the domestic situation that they face connecting up with the threat to America. That's al-Qaeda's strategic goal, to bankrupt America. And they have been successful beyond their dreams as we spend ourselves, our money, our people, and our global goodwill into bankruptcy with our misguided focus on Iraq. If we are to win our struggle against those who seek to do us harm, we must regain global and strategic perspective, reverse this misdirected deployment of our military resources in Iraq, and realign our military, intelligence, diplomatic, and other resources to address the threats to our nation's safety and security that are posed by al-Qaeda and its affiliates and sympathizers. We also need to acknowledge that military resources alone are not enough to win this fight. The 2006 annual report of the U.S. intelligence community states that the predominant immediate threats to our physical safety are terrorism and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Now, these are asymmetrical threats. Terrorism and, to an important degree, proliferation arise from stateless groups that are not deterred by massive weaponry or large standing armies. So, to effectively confront these threats, we have to move beyond a Cold War security strategy that emphasizes traditional military force. This is not a partisan issue. What I say here today echoes what's been said by leaders in this and prior administrations and members of both parties. The 9/11 Commission called for an increase in diplomatic development and humanitarian tools. My Nebraska colleague, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, who serves with me on both the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Intelligence Committee, recently said, quote, "You will never win anything in the long run with just military power. When you're dealing with terrorism, extremism, poverty, despair, those are problems far bigger than the military," unquote. Senators Biden and Lugar, the chairman and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, have both emphasized the need for more effective civilian-led foreign policy efforts, as have Secretary Gates, Defense Secretary Gates, former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and former Deputy Secretary of Defense Joseph Nye. The major strategic gap in our 21st century preparedness, then, is not a missile gap or a gap in military personnel and hardware measured against the armies and arsenals of another state. The major strategic gap is a deficit in the strength and variety of resources we must bring to bear on the asymmetric threats of today. An effective 21st century national security strategy must include improved resources to collect covert and public information, enhance multilateral diplomacy, and prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons. Our strategy must also encourage participatory, transparent, and fair government around the world and promote accountability and the rule of law. That's because these are key American principles and because ineffective, repressive, corrupt, and unresponsive governments can obviously provide a breeding grounds for extremism. Our military increasingly has taken on the roles of our civilian-led institutions because we have massive deficits in those civilian agencies in financial and human resources, in cultural and language capabilities, and in coherent interagency strategies to anticipate and respond to threats to our national security. We have to change our budgetary priorities to address these deficits. Even the greatest military arsenal in the world can't ensure the safety of populations or resolve conflicts around the globe, and yet we continue to spend hundreds of billions of dollars borrowed from China, Japan, and oil exporting countries on weapon systems designed for Cold War conflicts between states with comparable weapon systems. It is well past the time to shift our strategic thinking and our corresponding expenditures and actions beyond outdated military tools and solutions. Let me again quote Secretary Gates' budgetary views from his Kansas State University speech. He said, "We need a dramatic increase in spending on the civilian instruments of national security." This is the Defense Secretary. Diplomacy, strategic communications, foreign assistance, civic action, and economic reconstruction and development. Now, one way to increase this much-needed investment in the civilian instruments of national security is to cut wasteful spending on weapons programs that will not help us address our most pressing national security concerns. These include, for example, the F-22 Raptor, which Secretary Gates has specifically identified as a weapon system with limited relevance in counterterrorism operations. It has never flown in Iraq or Afghanistan, yet the Air Force continues to ask for more. I am pleased that the President's fiscal year 2009 budget attempts to increase the number of Foreign Service officers. As Secretary Gates and Rice have said, there are more personnel on a single aircraft carrier task force and more lawyers doing work for the Pentagon than there are Foreign Service officers. But assuming the President's proposals go forward, the net gains are unclear after accounting for the increased demands of Iraq and Afghanistan. The GAO reported at the end of last year that though the Department of State hired over 1,000 Foreign Service officers above attrition levels between 2002 and 2004, that increase was essentially consumed by the staffing demands of Iraq and Afghanistan programs. Even our modest efforts to enhance our civilian capacity then are being undermined by Iraq. This is also true with respect to our foreign information and intelligence capacity, to which I will now turn. 9/11 exposed major gaps in how intelligence critical to our national security was gathered, analyzed, and used. The 9/11 Commission reviewed those gaps and began a process of intelligence reform that prompted the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The work is far from complete, but at least a framework for change has been put into place. Now, another great challenge remains, however, one that is just as critical to fighting al-Qaeda as well as other threats to our national security. And unlike the reform efforts pursued thus far, it is broader than just the intelligence community. The problem is our deficits in information collection, as well as reporting and analysis. By information, I mean not just intelligence gathered clandestinely, but also information obtained through diplomatic reporting and all the overt channels through which our government learns about the rest of the world. Inside and outside the intelligence community, our government has failed to coordinate information collection across different departments and agencies. Our foreign information and intelligence will only be as good as the people we employ to gather it and their ability to operate in the places to which we send them. Yet, our intelligence deficit in human resources and collectors abroad is huge. The Office of the DNI estimates that between 1989 and 2001, during the administrations of both political parties, there was a 40% loss in intelligence human resources. Making up for that loss will take time. After all, it takes 5 to 7 years, apparently, to develop an experienced employee, and we are short of experienced employees. Just consider what the DNI has acknowledged, that two-thirds of our intelligence-related human resources with responsibilities for sub-Saharan Africa, an area with ongoing and, I think, growing al-Qaeda activities, have less than 5 years of knowledge and experience. Now, the answer to these deficits in numbers and experience cannot be what the DNI has called authority to, quote, lift and shift people to address the latest crisis. We need to develop the expertise that only years of study and experience can produce, and we need to preposition expert collectors around the world before crises arise. The 2006 Intelligence Community Annual Report said that the intelligence agencies are, quote, losing the war for talent, finding it difficult to recruit, motivate, and retain the best candidates for its positions, unquote. More specifically, the report noted, recruiting and retaining high-level skills in critical languages and scientific and technical fields remains difficult. Simply put, our national security depends on overcoming this particular challenge. Human resources is part of a larger set of problems and how we collect and analyze information. As I'll explain, these problems are entrenched and defy the ability of current institutions to correct them by themselves. For that reason, I introduced the legislation Steve mentioned at the beginning with Senator Chuck Hagel to establish a Foreign Intelligence and Information Commission. Our bill will establish an independent commission to address long-standing, systematic problems in the collection, reporting, and analysis of foreign intelligence, as well as diplomatic reporting and open source information. First, as the Director of National Intelligence has testified, we continue to direct disproportionate resources toward current crises rather than toward long-term strategic issues and emerging threats. Second, we don't have the geographic distribution of resources we need to anticipate threats around the world. The lack of global reach has also been acknowledged by the intelligence community leadership. And third, we lack a comprehensive approach to information collection conducted by the U.S. government as a whole, not only the intelligence community, but also the State Department and other government officers who are based in our embassies. This final point, that the problem and the solution are broader than the intelligence community, has also been acknowledged. Appearing before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Michael Leiter, the new director of the United States National Counterterrorism Center, specifically noted that much of the information about the instability that can lead to safe havens or ideological radicalization comes not from covert collection, but from open collection best done by Foreign Service officers. The problem is that it is not in the power of Mr. Leiter or anyone in the intelligence community to make sure that there are enough Foreign Service officers in the right places with the right resources, not something you can blame the intelligence community for. To put it simply, the government does not have a process for asking the following questions. What do we need to know, not only today but in the future? Who is best suited to get that information, and where do they need to be? Is our analysis up to the task? And how do we allocate resources across agencies so that these requirements are met with adequate funding and are focused on prevention, not just reaction? These big strategic questions are critical to our national security, yet they don't even get asked, much less answered. These issues extend well beyond the authorities of the DNI and the jurisdiction of any one congressional committee. That is why we need an independent commission to finally address them comprehensively and make recommendations for the executive branch and for Congress. I am pleased that the Senate Intelligence Committee has endorsed this approach by including the Feingold-Hagel bill and legislation that the committee approved authorizing intelligence activities for the upcoming fiscal year. Now, talking about information collection can sound a little abstract, but the implications are very real. Take, for example, our ability to address terrorist safe havens. As recently as the end of January, the State Department's counterterrorism chief, Lieutenant General Del Daley, publicly expressed concerns about what our intelligence services know and don't know about the threat in the Afghan-Pakistani tribal areas. He said, we don't have enough information about what's going on there, not on Al-Qaeda, not on foreign fighters, not on the Taliban, unquote. The same could be said about other safe havens identified by the State Department, including Somalia, the Sahel, and certainly certain areas of Southeast Asia. Around the world, potential instability looms, and political, economic, and social conditions that can contribute to terrorist safe havens persist. The question for our government is, how do we address these challenges before the crises arise? Do we need more clandestine collectors in these parts of the world? Or do we need more political officers in far-flung places so we can do a more robust diplomatic reporting? What does a U.S. embassy in one of these countries look like from an interagency collection and reporting perspective? Are more consulates and out-of-embassy posts in certain key countries part of the solution? And how do we connect the requirements of our embassies overseas to Washington, where budget requests and spending allocations should reflect a broad strategy for collecting information across different agencies? I think an independent commission will be able to ask and help to answer these questions. It'll be able to look at the intelligence community, the State Department, and other departments and agencies to ensure that strategic and budgetary planning is part of a larger interagency process. The commission will consider the role of the National Security Council and the OMB in this process, and it will look at the problem from top to bottom, interviewing NSC officials in Washington and visiting country missions overseas. This would not be a confrontational or accusatory investigation at all. It's an inquiry intended to produce concrete recommendations to fix long-standing problems. These recommendations will be of enormous benefit to whoever the next president is, and it will help Congress as it conducts oversight and considers the role of the intelligence community, the DNI, the State Department, and other agencies in the context of a broader strategy. There are other significant gaps in our security post-9/11, from this administration's inconsistent freedom agenda to our convoluted foreign assistance strategies to our domestic infrastructure needs. But I think I may need a separate invitation for another day to talk about those. But
done.
Thank you. But ultimately, the gaps that left us exposed here at home to the catastrophic attack we experienced on 9/11 remain with us. They present us with very real risks that are being left unaddressed, in part because of our military presence in Iraq. The longer we remain in Iraq, the longer we'll be unable to devote the human and financial resources these challenges urgently need. I appreciate the roles that this institution and this audience play in helping to bring these issues into focus. I'm hopeful that our voices and all their diversity will help inform decisions in a new administration that are in our best and collective interests. Nothing less than American security and future is at stake. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah. Take questions.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to ask Samir Lalwani to work around the, or I'm sorry, Ben Catcher, who's going to extend the microphone around the room. I'm going to open the floor in a moment. But let me just open with one question. Senator, you and Senator Hagel have made an important contribution to thinking about the structure of the intelligence side of this, but you've also addressed the sort of dismal state of the Foreign Service officer class. And Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell, and others, I think were proud somewhat that they left the State Department with a net positive in terms of the number of Foreign Service officers, but they also tell stories of how brutal those fights were to get there. And other than DOD lawyers, the other interesting statistic is that there are more musicians, military musicians, than there are Foreign Service officers in the world.
Well, they're probably more popular than the lawyers.
Yeah, but. And I guess the real question is, that's a big jump when you think about really rearranging the structure of that deployment. And Bob Gates, who has been saying, this has been basically saying, we need these folks out there,
right,
and help us because we can't help ourselves. So how do you make that next jump on the State Department side of this?
Well, it's tough, but as you say, having people from the military side, you know, sort of begging us to do this should help. Hopefully the new president will be somebody who can start fresh without people seeing having an agenda on this and say, look, we've got to do this. I mean, I best am able to illustrate this just from my own travels. In early 2001, I was in Nigeria, and of course went to Abuja, and we were in Lagos, and we got down to Port Harcourt, but we got up to Kano, an ancient Muslim community on the traditional trade routes going all the way to the Middle East. And I was there to deal with other issues. And it certainly did not have, the focus was not terrorism. But we saw on the street there postcards and pictures of both Gaddafi and Osama bin Laden. And I remember saying to my staff after a few of these encounters, you know, I'd like to get briefed on this. I was scheduled to be briefed on it 2 days after 9/11, I believe. We didn't have a presence up there. We didn't have a consulate. And it's a big city. It's a very important place. We didn't have ears on the ground. From the diplomatic side, or a presence to sort of counter some of the things that were going on there. And this is one of the places where a lot of the disputes about Sharia law and some of these issues that are so divisive within Nigeria are occurring. It's just an example of where I think a case can be made on national security grounds that to rely only on intelligence operations and to not simply be out there trying to collect through open source and information sources, we are missing an opportunity that is essential for understanding the risks that we have.
Thank you. Let me take questions here. Yes, Harlan Ullman.
Senator, I'm Harlan Ullman. Thanks for your comments. I'd like to ask a broader question about a commission that I think is even far more important than a commission on intelligence, and that's a commission on examining the role of Congress. Both branches of government are badly broken. Congress, as you know, has a lower popularity rating than this particular president. What do you think about the idea of really taking a look about how we fix some of the things that you, I think, know that are broken badly in Congress in terms of process, in terms of the budget, in terms of all sorts of distribution of power? What do you think can be done and what do you think must be done in that regard?
I've never thought about that specifically, but you know, there are elements of what happens in Congress that I've been witnessing for 16 years that seem to be need something to break through it, and that has to do particularly with things like earmarks and some of the rules that you can't change unless you get a super majority of the Senate to do it. Now there's a good movement going on that I've been very involved with to try to ban earmarks, and we are making some progress. But you know, the frustration that my constituents express: so why is it that you guys bring up a bill about Bosnia and then somebody offers an amendment on onion farmers in Texas? You know, it drives people crazy and it makes them very confused about their government. So, you know, I'm not going to call here for two commissions in one day, but I'm not ruling it out.
Brian Buehler.
Thank you, Senator Feingold. I'd like to ask you about FISA, which I guess is only sort of tangentially connected to what you were talking about before. Critics of the new legislation are focused mainly on the immunity provision within the bill, not because they necessarily want the telecoms to be punished for what they did, but because of the discovery process to learn what the president's terror surveillance program was like. How much would that immunity provision hamper Americans' ability to learn what went on then? Could the IG report clarify that? Could the next administration reveal a bit about that program?
Well, this is not tangential to the topic that I brought up today. I also am a member of the Judiciary Committee. So I'm a member of Judiciary, Foreign Relations, and Intelligence. I see all the different elements of this. This issue of proper collection of foreign intelligence is critical, both to our privacy and to our security. And this legislation gets it totally wrong. This legislation, it isn't just the immunity. And I do think this is a total farce with regard to the immunity. It basically guarantees the immunity, which doesn't simply have the impact of potentially allowing telephone companies to break the law. It may well prevent us from ever getting to the core issue that I've challenged since December 2005, which is the president ran an illegal program. I think it was essentially the equivalent of an impeachable offense. So yes, it may have that impact, but you know what I focus more of my attention on? The issues relating to what they're collecting and how there's no judicial oversight or any ability to do anything about it. I always hold up my little BlackBerry and I say, you know, every time you email my daughter or text message in England, anybody that contacts their son or daughter in Iraq, anybody that has a kid's junior year abroad, anybody that has a business associate anywhere around the world, all that is now sucked up into a database over which there's essentially no control for the first time in American history. This is an astonishing giveaway. And I'm blue in the face already trying to tell people that all of this has happened to you and your communications in a way that you never would have thought was possible in this country. So this needs to be changed, and we're going to fall over on this, and I'm very unhappy.
How many of your colleagues, both parties, sort of get that?
I don't know. It's been hard because, frankly, the tremendous and legitimate focus on the immunity issue has covered up and sat on top of this issue, which I have fought both in all the committees. I tried to get a ban on bulk targeting and reverse targeting. You know, we won some of the critical votes in Judiciary Committee, but it was reversed on the floor of the Senate. The Senate actually was much worse on this than the House. The House at least stood firm for a while. But I think the big story is ultimately not going to be that the telephone companies got immunity, which is wrong. It's that our personal conversations are now in a giant database somewhere over which we have no control.
I want to go to this gentleman right here, but before that, if the Democrats were to win the White House, Senator Feingold, how many of these powers that the executive branch has taken for itself do you think will be walked back?
I just had an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal
Sentinel check
yesterday.
It out. Let's post that on our website. Yeah. Milwaukee Journal will get it up for those online.
On this very subject, because, you know, it's just one of my worries. Is even if the guy that I want to win wins, Senator Obama, there's going to be some pretty smart lawyers around him, and he's a smart lawyer himself.
Hey, don't give up anything.
And they're going to say, Mr. President, you're the president. You have the responsibility to protect the prerogatives of the office. Here is what your predecessor asserted, seemingly successfully, with regard to his power, whether it be signing statements, disregarding laws relating to torture, claiming that Article 2 of the Constitution overrides clear expressions of law. I believe that Barack Obama will do the right thing, but the pressure on him to keep some of that instead of reordering the constitutional balance, I would like to see President Obama or President McCain in the inaugural address. I don't want it to be too long because it's cold up there, but I think a few sentences saying, I will return to the founders' balance. I will maintain executive power to protect the American people and to do my job, but I will renounce the lawless claims of the previous administration. I think that's one of the most important claims.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Senator Feingold, my name is Nick Giuliano. I write for rawstory.com. Staying on FISA, I was wondering if you could trace if you think there's any chance to get immunity out or fix this at all in the Senate. And also, I was wondering if you could share your take on Senator Obama's statement regarding the FISA update that he released on Friday.
I'm very worried we're not going to be able to prevail. Senator Dodd and I and Senator Leahy are going to do everything we can to stop this mistake, but I'm extremely concerned that not only virtually every Republican, but far too many Democrats will vote the wrong way on amendments and opportunities to question both the immunity piece and the piece that I talked about in terms of Title I, the expansion of power and the lack of protection of private conversation. So I don't know for sure what Senator Obama is going to do, but Democrats should be voting against this.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator, my name is Hillary Eschenberg from the Connect U.S. Fund. I appreciate your comments about Al-Qaeda being a threat, and I was wondering if what substantial recommendations you have for continuing to influence foreign policy on actually addressing Al-Qaeda, and not only Al-Qaeda, but the Taliban as they continue to grow.
Well, you know, two weeks ago I had the privilege of doing a foreign relations trip to Pakistan and India. I actually got to see the Fatah region from the air and Afghanistan border, and had extensive meetings with Pakistani leaders, some of their intelligence people, and the local leaders in Pakistan. You know, that's where the threat is. And we even had this, there's a very difficult issue there. The Pakistanis, or many of them, are interested in the new government in making agreements, ceasefire agreements, with various groups in that region. And some of these people might be just fine. Some of them are Taliban. And some are Al-Qaeda. And I had to communicate, as other senators did who were there, that we cannot tolerate a situation where they reach some kind of an internal deal when Osama bin Laden and some of his top lieutenants are in Pakistan, and where there are cross-border attacks on our troops and the coalition troops in Afghanistan. That's a non-starter. That's not a negotiable thing for us. So we had to communicate that these agreements, even though they sound like peace agreements, may be just the opposite for us. So that is an example of where we need more focus and more attention, as opposed to being obsessed with this stuff about whether the surge is working to do what in Iraq.
Right.
This is much more central to our national security.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Elena Petrescu, and I work for Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin from the state of Wisconsin.
My congresswoman.
Yep. So I wanted to say, how is it that Congress is the Do Change Congress as opposed to the 109th Congress, but yet continues to vote along with the Bush administration? For instance, the continued funding without limitations to withdraw from Iraq, as well as with the Biden immunity. The Democrats have the majority, but yet voted and passed both of those bills. How did that occur?
Interesting questions, yes, and in the very back.
Well, I couldn't be more disappointed. I mean, I would give the Democrats very high marks on domestic issues and on what we've been able to accomplish. Those who say we've done nothing are just wrong. From the bill that Senator Obama and I passed about lobbying ethics reform, to raising CAFE standards, to college loans and dealing with interest rates, we've done a lot of good things. And the other things we couldn't do domestically were largely because of the filibuster, not because of Democrats' failure. The reverse is true when it comes to the post-9/11 challenges. We have failed to stay together on getting us out of Iraq as the American people expected, and I'm deeply disappointed in those who have not voted the right way on this. This is not Senator Harry Reid's fault. He's been very strong. He was with me on Feingold Reid, which is the strongest bill to get us out of there. And the performance has been even worse on this issue of FISA, where Democrats enabled, not the leadership, not Senator Rockefeller, at least in the early stages, not Senator Levin, but some of the rank-and-file Democrats in the Senate who were elected on this reform platform, unfortunately voted with Kit Bond, who is just giggling, he's so happy, with what he got. We caved in.
You know, there's not just Feingold Reid and Feingold Obama, but there's also Feingold McCain, or McCain Feingold. How are things going with that relationship?
Just fine. Yeah. We're friends. He's never endorsed me for political office, and I've never endorsed him for political office. We're friends. I'm supporting Senator Obama.
Okay. Yes, sir, right here. Can we just leave that on so we're not going on and off? On the switch? Okay.
Senator,
yes, sir.
I'm Fari Boris Fatemi with the Oxfordshire Group.
Ben, we can't hear it. It's not on. Just leave it on and do not turn it off. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Senator, I'm Fari Boris Fatemi with the Oxfordshire Group. Thank you for your presentation and the work you do every day in the United States Senate. I wanted to ask you about Iran. The mantra around town continues on and on and on that Iran is involved in the weaponization of nuclear materials to weaponize a military weapon. The 16 intelligence, National Intelligence Agency report of December said that they stopped that in 2003. In May, the International Atomic Energy Agency said that after 14 unannounced visits in the last 13
I'm going to encourage you to get to the question because there's so many.
Right,
so
right.
Just we know the history, so what's the question?
Right. The question is, why does this continue on when there's no evidence that there's any weapons program going on?
And well, the inquiry has to continue. I have no problem with people saying we have, I mean, we got was a public NIE that talked about the fact that it was not continued for a while. So we, you know, the problem is the administration wants to just, you know, have sort of the conclusion, which is, you know, they're still doing it and they're going to figure out a way to prove it, just like they did with Iraq. But we have to be honest about this. And we have to watch very carefully. Other countries disagree with us on this. Other countries think that they're moving forward. There's disputes within our own government. I just think it has to be as objective, nonpartisan analysis of this and respond appropriately. I don't think we can allow Iran to become a nuclear weapons power. But, you know, the overreaction to this and the hyping of this by the administration is one of the most damaging things that goes on.
When Tom Fingar of the National Intelligence Council was asked a similar question, I raised this question about what was called a memorandum to holders, meaning the holders of the sort of full report, and whether or not a memorandum, which is he called an update, would be appropriate to see if any of the key findings have been done. And he said it might, in fact, be appropriate to do that, and it's something that maybe a senator from a congressional perspective could be encouraged.
I really hope that in this new administration that we can start clean on this. Mm-hmm. Whoever the new president is, let's get away from all this. And let's at least have this be an area where people are just trying to get the right answer instead of playing political games.
Right, right. Yes, right here. And then we'll move back to the back. I see the gentleman in the very back will come back. Yes, right here.
I just want to ask, you talk about trying to get information out on Iran and other issues, but it seems that one of the core issues with oversight and with getting information out is the classification system, which is still run by the executive and isn't run under congressional authorization.
Question,
I was wondering, are there any movements towards getting to some sort of congressional authorization for a classification system that gives you guys access?
Well, this is a terrible battle we have all the time with the administration, and including their willingness to provide us with things that I think the Intelligence Committee should automatically be provided. This is something that we fight within the committee, within the Congress, but it may require some fundamental changes in the whole system because again, maybe we're going to have a different environment with a new president. So I am willing to wait and see, whether a new president will take a more reasonable attitude about this before wholesale reform, but it may be necessary.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Senator, my name's Ted Gotch. I'm with Telecommunications Reports. Just quickly back to FISA. A lot of folks have said, obviously earlier this year, the Senate overwhelmingly voted for the version of the bill that you were a strong opponent against. This bill, many people say, is an improvement in areas of immunity and others, even if incrementally so. What do you say to those who take that stance, and realistically with the Dems having helped push it over overwhelmingly last time at the passage, what's realistically
my response is that's a farce and it's political cover. It's not true. It's not true. It's nothing but window dressing, and anybody who claims that this is an okay bill is, I really question if they've even read it.
Bill Hartung with New America.
Yes. What's your position or take on the increasing privatization of intelligence? If we don't have the trained people in government, is this just a necessary evil? How do we deal with this going forward?
It worries me, and it doesn't mean that I'm not for any sort of help in that regard, but yes, I think it gets more and more dangerous, more and more subject to other concerns and other interests, and I would prefer that these things be done at a governmental level whenever possible.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Senator, thank you. I'm Mike Kraft, former State Department Counterterrorism Office and former Foreign Relations Committee staffer, and I've been following the 150 account of Foreign Affairs for years. And part of the problems that you alluded to on State Department funding and foreign aid is the unwillingness of Congress, especially the appropriators, in getting approving funding requests for it. Do you see any likelihood of this really changing significantly in the future?
I do. I think it was changing after 9/11, and the attitude in the Congress and the attitude in the country was very unified and be willing to say, okay, we may need to do stuff like this. Iraq messed us up and soured it. What can happen with this new administration is the new president can come and say, look, we need to do stuff like this, and we need to put more money into it, and I don't think the American people are going to just scoff at it. We have to undo the damage of the Iraq thing, but I think there's a great opportunity. I mean, the unity in this Congress after 9/11 until we went into Iraq was really something to behold. It was very, very good, and then it was destroyed by that decision. So I think we should come back at that.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Senator, thank you. Adam Nielsen from the German Embassy. Firstly, before I became disenfranchised, I was a resident of Wisconsin, so thank you.
We have the most Germans of any state in the country.
Yes. Tell me a bit about S-970 and the Russia 123 agreement language, and whether you think
970, that help me out.
The Iran Sanctions Act, and whether your committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, will have something to do with keeping the Russia language in or out.
Well, I'm hoping some modifications can occur in that way. That's given me pause, as well as some other aspects of it. There's overwhelming support for having legislation, but I do hope that the Foreign Relations Committee will take a look at that.
Hamid Arsalan from CSIS. You just mentioned that militaristic options are not the only options. So I want to see your view, because the DoD budget is, for example, $627 billion U.S. dollars. What are the other fractions for AID and the State Department is only 6.5%, which will be $42 billion.
Need you to move to question. You're talking too fast. So question.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
How can we balance, if you want to, for example, use the smart power terms, how
right.
can we balance this huge imbalance that we have, for example, the DoD budget, $627 billion, and the State Department and EID budget that they work in the development sector, only like $42 billion?
Well, I don't think you do it. I don't think you do it by sort of trying to equalize money. I think you do it by looking at what is working and what combination of resources are going to work in a particular location. You know, for example, the issues involving Ethiopia now and Somalia. You know, what would work there to relieve people's suffering, both in Somalia and Ethiopia, but at the same time recognizing that there are some very serious political issues with regard to the conduct of the Ethiopian government within its own country and its involvement in Somalia, and of course the huge numbers of issues involving the Somalian situation.
Yes, sir.
Another badger, Senator.
Yes, sir.
Following up on a couple of questions, do you and or Senator Dodd plan to filibuster the current proposed FISA legislation? Secondly, following up the question in front, what are you doing as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee to reduce the level of private contracting of core intelligence functions? And what are you doing as a member of that committee, if anything, to address the inherent conflicts of interest when you contract out core intelligence functions?
Thanks. Can you hand it to Alan Gerson behind? Thanks.
I'm not in a position at this time to talk about exactly what's going on with that within the committee, so I just can't. But at some point, I hope I am able to do that. With regard to Senator Dodd and myself, we met with Senator Reid on Friday morning, and we indicated our desire that this thing not just be jammed through. We will be requiring key procedural votes and also be taking some time on the floor this week to indicate the problems with this legislation. We're not just going to let it quickly pass.
Alan?
Alan Gerson, Gerson International Law Group.
I need you to speak up, Alan.
Alan Gerson, Gerson International Law Group. Senator, could you address the proclivity or lack of proclivity of the administration towards military confrontation with Iran?
Well, you know, I've never had a problem on the face of it when the president indicates the options need to be on the table for Iran. The problem is leading with it. The problem is not sort of, when pushed, indicating that all the options are on the table. It's giving the impression that this is sort of what he's thinking about, and I hope it isn't. But that gives a terrible impression. I mean, obviously, I'm horrified by Iran's president and his remarks. Iran is a great threat. But look at it another way. You're Iran. And the United States has invaded and taken over the country to your left and to your right. Most people would get nervous. At least where I'm from, that makes you a little nervous. Like if somebody had taken over Michigan and Minnesota, you know, you get a little edgy. So that's oversimplifying it. But to not understand the psychology of how Iranians must feel, apart from Minajad and the outrageous stuff he says, we have to figure out a way to reassure and work with Iranians in a way that they will pressure their government to do the right thing, not go with weaponization, and have a better relationship with us.
Right here.
Reg Smith, I retired from the Foreign Service. I agree with you. My question concerns Iran. The with the are you in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee worried that the administration may be building the case for the military option?
Well, that's been a concern for a long time of many senators and many constituents. There is a fear that somehow they'll try to take some kind of a dramatic action before the end of this administration. I don't think it'll happen myself, but it's nerve-wracking, and having been lied to repeatedly to go into a war like Iraq, people, just like Iran gets edgy when we invade both sides of them, the American people are edgy with regard to the possibility that something like that would be attempted.
This gentleman right here.
Senator Feingold, CMIC Tehran for with Voice of America.
I need you to use your lungs.
Sure. You put emphasis on the role of political officers, robust diplomacy. We haven't had a relationship with Iran for 30 years. And Senator Hagel just suggesting opening up a consulate in Iran. I mean, what are your thoughts on this issue and how realistic is in the current...
For those who didn't hear it, it's a question of opening a consulate in Iran. How realistic is this?
I don't know how realistic it is, and I'd have to think about it. It would be something I think would be great if we could do without compromising our principles or safety of people, but it's something I want to examine.
We have a ton of questions still left. I'm going to take Margaret at the last, but before Margaret goes, I want to ask one question on the Foreign Relations Committee side of your portfolio and to somewhat the nuances there in diplomacy. In Israel, in Israel-Palestine issues, it was frankly fascinating to watch the Turks announce that they were essentially trying to broker a peace arrangement between Israel and Syria. This last couple of days, the EU has announced that it's going to end its sanctions against Cuba. And to some degree, I've always been interested in degree if you could open up pathways of some sort to Syria without necessarily appeasing the bad guys, could you somehow rob Iran of some of the turf that it has in the region? And likewise in Cuba, if you could open up some pathways, could you rob some turf from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela?
Sure.
And I'd be interested in your views on both Syria and Cuba before we go to Margaret and close.
Well, I do think that's the case. I mean, that is one of the things that has led, I think, Syria and Israel to be talking to each other. This is a very difficult time for Sunni Arab countries or Sunni Arab countries with Shia minorities. So this is a delicate time when this whole Iranian situation is so potentially destabilizing, along with the complete instability in Iraq, that there is a moment where they may see it in their interest to do it. So yes, I think that's very positive, and the Israelis are seeking to do this. With Cuba, obviously the change is coming. I think the change will be a very positive one. I think it'll be an exciting moment for our country, economically exciting for the Cuban people. And yes, I do think it will help us countering those that badmouth the American people and the American government in South America, because the Cuba thing has been a whipping boy that they've had forever. We eliminate that and have a decent relationship with an improved and democratic and respectful of human rights Cuba, and I think you can have enormous value throughout the region.
Thank you. Margaret, last question.
Margaret Hanock, retired clandestine service officer.
I wasn't going to out you, but now that you've done yourself.
I've been outed by everybody, why not? And I suspect this is a question that's better asked offline than this forum.
But
having survived the 9/11 Commission, the Rob Silberman Commission, sort of survived the DNI, I retired in March of 07, I'm just curious as to when you've put your commission together, the number of people who've actually gone through the process of running the CT effort in an embassy from as the DNI reps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are you going to have more people like that than people who were on the previous commissions? Did that make any sense?
That's an important point. We have a process where each of the four leaders of the Congress would pick three people. But that viewpoint has to be represented. And in fact, that's why I proposed this. I came back from a trip to Africa. I won't say the country. And I met with some of our key people there. And the level of responsibility they have for the importance of the task and the potential issues, there's no comparison. And that led me to say to my staff, what can we do about this? And this is how this whole thing came to be, was from my conversations with people on the ground in those countries, people like you and others.
As always, Senator, thank you for working on these tough issues, thinking them through. And we're particularly, you know, New America is sort of a purple institution. We have people on all sides here, but we are trying to think about structural deficits in a lot of the national security arena. I want to thank you. You have an open invitation for that next invite you'd like to give. Thank you very much. Thank you.